Welcome back to the Discovering Forestry podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Corey Lofi, alongside our friend, Mr. Arborjet Joe Aitken, here for another compelling conversation about trees. Joe, right now we're in the middle of a blizzard. Snow is coming down. I know something worked its way on the Midwest. It's on the East Coast. Schools are shutting down. Man, I love it.
You know, we need a good big old winter storm. We don't get them anymore. So for our listeners, I'm sitting in my hotel room in Toronto, and I got 5 inches, or do they call them 10 centimeters? So however you want to add it, it's still about the same. But then we got rain. It's just a nasty day. So it's interesting. We knew that this was coming. We knew that the first quarter involves you and I out and about a lot, cool events, trade shows. I got to hang out with one of our good friends at the ISA Ontario booth. We got some good peeps over there, talking trees. It's good. But what struck me today is that I made a comment to a woman arborist, Sarah, at the ISA Ontario booth. We're just talking about oddities in the industry. And at first, which will lead us into our discussion with our special guest tonight, is that she found a book from like 1895 for women in gardening and how to support your man. And I started laughing because I'm going to help with the keynote presentation at ISA's anniversary. And part of the evolution of ISA is the evolution of gender equality and more women in this industry. So I was laughing. I says, I need to get a copy of that for the presentation. But another thing is that you and I know that in this industry, you have to continue to learn. And I learned something today. And I hope that this kind of directs us in the direction for our conversation this evening with our guest is that I had a lilac tree bloom in October in my backyard. And I'm thinking, what? And it was the weirdest thing. I'm looking at the plant. There was no leaves on it, but the white flowers popped open. I'm like, what is going on with that? So we're discussing it in the ISA Ontario's booth. And Sarah goes, really? We're talking about it. I says, yeah, it's right behind my son's soccer net. And it's getting drilled with a soccer ball. She goes, a lot of the growth hormones are in the outer twigs. And because you're probably breaking branches, it could be triggering something because the tree never acclimated to cold temperatures because we never had cold temperatures yet. And because you were constantly hitting that tree, it could have triggered something. And at first I'm thinking, interesting theory. I've never thought about that. But I've never seen a lilac bloom, but I've never seen one get hit with a soccer ball 100 times. So is there a connection? So what my point is that even that we've been in the industry as long as we have and how we've got here, this is a continued education. This is a learning process. And I think everybody learns at a different pace. So I'm hoping that we can get into that in today's topic. So our conversation. So why don't you do the honor of introducing our special guest this evening? It may be she can shed some light on him. Am I crazy? Are we crazy? Or is there something to it?
Well, Joe, we know you're crazy, but I am too. So it's all good.
Yeah, well, we are.
Our special guest, I've sat in on a number of her lectures over the years across the country, actually, not just localized to Colorado or where I was in the Midwest, but all over the country. She gets around because she's got a lot of really good information, and she's pushing the boundaries and been pushing the boundaries with some of the work she's been doing over the years. So without any further ado, I'd like to bring Stephanie Adams onto the show. Stephanie, how are you? Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Joe and Corey. It's really great to be here. I'm pretty excited. things are going well here. We also got snow here in Chicagoland. So Yeah, after we record this, I have to go out and plow my driveway before it becomes a big sheet of ice. But it's Illinois in January.
Yeah, we've been fortunate that we've skipped a lot so far this year. So we need it. Bring
Yeah.
it.
Yeah, one of the questions that we've been brain a bunch of us at work have been brainstorming about is especially climate change and how that's going to affect plants directly and indirectly. And so directly looking at precipitation changes, temperatures, those sort like immediate resources that the tree uses and how they're going to change, but also indirectly, so how this is going to affect insect populations, fungal behavior, all that sort. And especially, climate change is going to be the primary stressor, but then these biotic or abiotic agents are going to be secondary. So those dynamics are all going to change, and we don't know exactly what it's going to look like.
Well, let's talk about this. Let's bring some of the listeners who maybe haven't seen you present up to speed. What's a little bit about your background, either your education, how you got into the industry, or just kind of a synopsis of where you've been?
Yeah, currently I hold a PhD in technically forestry pathology because I was in the School of Forestry at the University of Florida. I got my master's in plant pathology from the University of Georgia, and then I was a botany major with a minor in urban forestry at Western Illinois University. But that was not where I thought my future would go, especially when I was 18. So I got into the industry because of the urban forestry minor and taking classes with Tom Green. And too, it was kind of a natural progression because I was always the kid in the backyard, either gardening. My dad got me into gardening, and so he taught me how to plant things and maintain them. And then I was also the kid outside mixing potions in a 5 gallon bucket behind the shed. And so it kind of makes sense that I'm where I'm at, but I never imagined to be here. Yeah, especially when I was 18. So I was a solid C student when I graduated high school. I think I did like a 2.6 or something. K through 12 was kind of my own personal hell. And so when I got ready to go to college, I took the ACT and got an 18. And because the score was so bad, I studied really hard and took it again and got a 17. Yeah, ask me how I do on standardized tests.
Hey, I think Joe and I are with you. A lot of our listeners are probably too.
Yeah,
Oh,
and
no.
so my parents were insistent that I was going to get some sort of secondary education. Neither one of my parents went to college. My dad barely graduated high school. They're like, you're going to do something. So I was actually looking into going into welding for a while, because you can make it's a really good career. And it's, working with your hands, and I'm a very hands-on learner. And so I was accepted to Western Illinois University because I knew I wanted to do botany. I wanted to work with plants. And so, I was accepted basically under this like academic probation kind of program where they're like, we don't know how this student's gonna do. So we're gonna give them some extra counseling and like how to function in the college environment kind of classes. But once I found botany and urban forestry, like everything was up from there. It's nice when something finally clicks and it makes your heart sing.
You mentioned Tom Green, and my first thought was Tom Green, the comedian. So that's not the guy that you met.
Yeah, there's also apparently a polygamist named Tom Green. So he would make a lot of jokes about it because, and it's funny because he's a pretty modest person.
Was this at Western Illinois when you met him? So you
I
realize that you got probation. That's when you met him. And I wanted to bring him up only because I feel like right off the bat of this conversation, you've had mentors through the years or someone that sparked your interest to follow a path. And I'm glad that guys like Tom find a way to make that connect with you because you do such an amazing job now that it would be kind of hard to believe that you're not doing what you're doing. Mm. So I just wanted to, for our listeners to make sure that, and have you seen him since you graduated?
Oh yeah. We go out and have lunch every once in a while.
All right. Fantastic.
Yeah. Fantastic. No, and that's what was really great about, you know, I actually kind of refer to Tom as my academic father. But yeah, his classes were really great because they were all hands-on learning for the most part, which just most people in the tree care industry are hands-on learners. And so it really worked well. And he's just a really good patient teacher. And then while I was also at Western, I met who I refer to as my academic mother, who's her name is Susan Myers. She is actually a phycologist, which is the study of algae. So she was working on the genetics of algae in the Mississippi River, especially looking at like healthy water ways and that sort. But hers was the first lab I worked in. And so she kind of teases me now for not becoming a phycologist. I had her for plant physiology. And so I tell her, I'm like, well, I kind of study a lot of oomycetes now, like Phytophthora pythium and Phytopythium, and they're more closely related to algae than fungi. So I'm kind of a phycologist. So
yeah,
it's a stretch.
A little bit of a pull, but it's all related. Mm-hmm. You know, as we're looking at the big picture and kind of how we ping pong from either employer or position at companies or learning experiences, Joe brought it up earlier. You're learning everywhere from everybody. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
It's all connected, people.
Yep.
Yeah. And you said working for our employer, I've had, you got me thinking back to some of the guys that made differences for me. And I think if I had to mention somebody just a little off topic, it would be Paul Schwartz. And Paul Schwartz was the campus arborist for Michigan State University for 30 years. And I had a chance to roll with him for 20 something years on campus on what forestry was doing, urban forest, you know, all the stuff they did on campus. But it's an amazing, and it's amazing that you have these people in your lives. And I think maybe because I'm getting a little bit older and a little more melancholy, it's nice to remember these people that pointed you or guided you or, you know, nudged you, because we talked about, you know, before we started recording that, you know, sometimes it's hard to learn some of this stuff. And you're right. I think you're right. In this green industry, we are a hands-on. I learn it better by putting my hands on it than we are just reading a book. So I think that's something we could probably talk a little bit more on, is finding a way to make that connection with the people that you're trying to educate. And I was taught that there's education is a triangle, see, read, do, or something like that. So you gotta find a perfect way of that balance of that three, and not everybody learns the same. So that as you're out and about presenting, you gotta find a way to connect. How do you do that? How do you lean on it? Do you lean on your experience on what helps you connect with it? It's tough.
Yeah. I think I learned this idea a while ago, and it was, be the person you needed when you were younger.
I love it.
Wow.
And so I teach in a way that I wish I had been taught. So actually a year ago I was diagnosed with ADHD, which was kind of refreshing. And when I told my parents, my sister, and they're like, yeah, we've known this since you were like two. I'm like, okay, well, thanks. You know, people with ADHD are hands-on learners. We have difficulty sitting down, and that sort. And so especially higher education, but K-12 and then secondary education, definitely favors seeing and listening learners. And so hands-on learners are at a disadvantage in those formats. And so that's why a lot of people go into the trades, because it works with how they learn a little bit better. And so with my presentations, like if it's just me sitting with a microphone in front of a screen, I at least tried to explain it in a way that anybody who's even not familiar with the topic can at least understand, or they can relate to it somehow. But really, one thing that I've been doing more and more is doing more hands-on workshops where I actually bring plants in and dissect them in front of people. And so they can actually feel the mushy roots, and they can smell, you know, the bacterial soft rot, or they can feel the weight, because, you know, a lot of it goes to watering and then root rot pathogens, which I think have largely been overlooked in the green industry in general. And so, yeah, I'd much rather bring in a tarp. And so that's been really helpful. And one way I've accomplished this is actually at the Illinois Arborist Association, our annual conference, is we've created the Plant Healthcare Corner. Because I was looking, I'm like, we have every conference has a tree climbers corner, but I'm like, plant healthcare is the other like third of the industry, the other third being like the sales consulting. And I'm like, why isn't there a plant healthcare corner? And so the first year we did it, brought in logs and we gave opportunities to all the vendors who do like injection equipment or anything like that, and let people try their equipment out. Like, so they got to demonstrate what it was, and then they could use it, you know, themselves. And part of that too is also trying to reach people, because some people, and I'm kind of one of these people, going up to a vendor at their booth, like it's one-on-one, like you kind of feel like it's awkward for me. And so I'd much rather learn in a classroom style. And then, you know, if everybody gets up and everybody's trying it, I'll try it too, but I'm less likely to do that if it's just one-on-one. And, I'm actually pretty introverted. Doing it that way, but I inherited Jim Schuster's huge collection of insects and pathogens and diseases and everything. And so we set all of his displays out in organized ways, you know, create quizzes based on them. People can look at them, but yeah, bringing in plant samples, or even we do soil testing. So people, if they want to get a hand at how to make those soil ribbons to do soil typing. But yeah, try to bring as much hands-on learning. You know, if you are out in the field, these are the things that you could easily do when doing consulting and actually give your clients more services very easily and cheaply.
Do a better job, be well-rounded. Cause I'm betting a lot of people haven't been exposed to making ribbons out of soil. A lot of people probably haven't touched some of these insects or been this close to some of these pests that they might hear about in a conference on a slideshow. So good on you.
Yeah, my mind's a little blown when I ask people, they'll tell me, oh, this tree's dying, or they tell me about this plant, and they tell me about all the above ground symptoms. And I'm like, well, how do the roots look? And they're like, what? I'm like, the roots.
What?
And he's like, and you know, they're usually like, oh, I didn't see any stem girdling roots. So they're talking about the woody structural roots. And I'm like, well, sure, the woody structural roots are largely what the green industry has been taught how to deal with since the 90s. We know they should look like a supposed kind of bicycle, but I'm like, those are not the roots that are absorbing water and nutrients. You know, anything with bark is not absorbing water and nutrients. Those are pretty right. Watertight to prevent water loss. And so I think one of the big things that I really kind of started in the last few years is teaching people about what fine roots actually look like and what a healthy fine root system looks like. I'm like, you can identify a root rot easily in the field. You don't know which pathogen it is. You don't know if it's like an oomycete or true fungi. So you have to have it diagnosed in order to know how to properly treat it. But
you can smell it.
You can't, well, smells are usually bacteria. That's usually bacterial soft rot. That's excess water. But that's one of the first things I do too, is smell the soil. And people are like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm smelling the soil. And they're like, and I think most people have had like house plants where you up pot them and like the soil, the roots are just sour. They're acrid. That is a bacterial soft rot.
Now we know.
That's pretty amazing, because I circled smell. And you know what, believe it or not, you know, people back then, they used to laugh at farmers, because he'd go out to the field, pick a handful up and just smell it. And you know what he had to do? People don't realize that, you know, because I got big into compost teas. And if a batch goes bad when it goes anaerobic, oh, it's horrible.
Oh, yeah.
It's horrible. But I, you know what? I couldn't, in one hand, I don't think I could ever count how many arborists through 40 years actually talk about using smell.
Oh, yeah. That's really a pathology thing. That I think that's a lot of my plant pathology background, because I learned that from my major advisor when I was at Georgia. She did extension. Her specialty was ornamentals and forestry. And yeah, just the intro to pathology class, like you have to look at the entire organism. I mean, it would be like you going to the doctor and they're like, oh, but we're not going to look in your at your feet. Or like, look at half of your body.
Yeah, you're limping, but who cares about your feet? Yeah, why not? I just came up with an invention for you. So Steph, you're going to have to write a book now.
I've been talking about that for a while.
In the back, you can have scratch and sniff diseases. So remember when we were kids? You can scratch it and smell it.
Oh, the scratch and sniff book. I thought we were going to go into like, okay, all right, Joe, I'm with you.
All right. We keep going, but I'm thinking it's an amazing tool if you know how. But I know if you smell something bad, you're going to remember what it smells like. But
right.
Oh my God. Sorry. I went off on a tangent. I'll scratch that one out for you.
But go on, Stephanie,
it's like just the field diagnostic process. So one of the kind of the soapbox issues that I've been, or the soapbox, yeah, issues I've been talking about a lot is, bringing plant healthcare into the 21st century. There's a lot of things we do in plant healthcare in the tree care industry in general that are just antiquated. And I think part of it is either people don't know these resources exist, or they don't fully understand the value in what they can offer. And so I'm going to stick on the root rot issue. So when I go out and look at a tree that is struggling for some reason, one, you're going to look at the canopy symptoms and read the tree's body language. And it's really interesting. I've been talking more and more about trees' body language, and people look at me like I'm a little crazy, but I'm like, does anybody have a dog or a cat or a bird? Do your pets communicate with you? Right. And most of them were like, oh yeah. I'm like, so nonverbal communication, right? You can go out and look at a plant and look at the plant, and that plant's telling you that something's going wrong. So then you just have to, look at that a little bit closer, which I've presented this quite a bit of like, if it's only in one branch, the problem is at the base of that branch, right? Because all you have to look at is where's water and nutrients not getting to a location, right?
Go on. Keep going.
So if you look at the entire canopy and you have staghorning or dead branches sticking out the tips all across the canopy, water and nutrients aren't getting to the tips of those branches. So you have to think about it. Okay, what are the odds of, a squirrel going and chewing on each one of those branches and girdling it? Pretty slim. It's not going to happen. What's the chance of a fungal canker only targeting all those little branch tips? Again, probably pretty slim. Most cankers are secondary anyway. And so then it's going to be like, okay, what tissue is supplying this giant area of the canopy, right? It's either going to be the main stem, which you can easily look at for maybe you got hit by a car. Maybe there's a rope tied around the base of it. Maybe it's girdled by roots. And if the main stem and the root layer look fine, then it's the fine roots.
And I think I was in one of your presentations. It was maybe Idaho or Oregon or something. And you used a very similar line, and you're talking about, that water has to travel from those very fine roots out to those stem tips and those branch tips. That is literally the furthest that they have to pull and move that water. So why aren't we looking there more often? And I think you hit it on the head.
Oh yeah. So all pathology, all plant pathology or pathology in general is it's a dysfunction of normal physiology. And so it's just a disruption of that organism's normal functioning. And so you have to know a lot of plant physiology to understand those dynamics, and then you have to understand the pathogens and what they require and see, where the disease triangle is completed. And then to figure out management is like, okay, which one of those can I eradicate? And which one's going to be the most effective and the least, caustic the environment and non-target organisms. But anyways, Yeah, tree physiology, like at stomates in like the redwoods, you know, the pressure of the water pressure within the stomates is like negative 220 pounds of pressure, which is mind-boggling, especially if you think about it, the largest pump in the world can't draw water up more than 10 meters or 26 feet approximately. And that's because at that height, it's heavier than gravity.
Yeah, and it should be on fire or boiling by the time it gets there.
Right, yeah. You get the boiling because it's cavitation. It's turning into a gas because of the pressure. And yet with capillary action and transpiration and all these different forces within the tree, the trees are able to do it, which just the engineering of trees is really, really cool.
Millions of years ahead of us. Trees.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's really interesting because if you think about it, you know, the oldest known living trees, like in a decent population, is the bristlecone pines. Yeah. And they can be, you know, they're over 7,000 years old, which I think is too, what fascinates me about trees and diseases is that when an environment becomes unfavorable, animals leave. You know, herbaceous plants will produce more seeds to spread their seeds further. That tree is there for 7,000 years. It has to have a pretty incredible immune system and ways to adapt to that environment and the pathogens and insects in that environment.
What's amazing is that, like Corey said, that's just a blink of the eye in the 200 to 300 million years that tree's been on the planet. So, it's 7,000 years old. You're like, blink, it's over.
But we have a hard time keeping, you know, landscape trees and street trees alive. Right. We digress too far. I want to go back to the root rots because I want to make a point.
Okay, go back.
So the process is then you know it's the root rot. It's a root rot of some sort. So again, dig down into the soil, which, you know, I need to do a lot of writing in my life to get these things on paper to be resources for the folks. But, you know, again, you smell the soil first. Does it stink? Then it's probably too much water, and that's a bacterial soft rot. The plant's not too far gone. Change the drainage, reduce watering, and usually it's able to solve itself. But with root rots, if it's either a fungus, so true fungi are more closely related to animals, while the oomycetes, so Phytophthora phytopithium, are more closely related to algae and plants. And so that's really important to have those diagnosed because you can't use the same fungicide for the two. And so, and this is where, you know, there's many ways to approach things and manage things. So if you only want to apply one fungicide, you have to have it diagnosed, or it's a flip of a coin. You're making a guess. And unfortunately, in the green industry, and this is across the board, is that people like lumping, you know, symptoms. So, you know, all declining oaks have oak wilt, all declining elms have Dutch elm disease, right? You know, if it has vascular streaking, you know, in an elm, people are like, oh, it has Dutch elm disease. I'm like, well, what are the other two diseases that have vascular streaking? And how do you make that distinction in the field? Because I can't make that distinction. So I would love to learn how you're doing it.
Send it in.
Yeah. And so, right. So, so bringing plant healthcare into the 21st century is treating a diagnosis, not a symptom.
Wow. No, because you're right, because we had issues. Right now in the Midwest, I'm not sure if you're having it on your side of the lake. Arbs.
Arbs. Oh, it's rhizoctonia. It's all rhizoctonia. That's it's everything diagnosed. So especially...
don't even send a sample. Like, no symptoms. Stephanie knows.
Like, it's just, it's, you know, just... It's awesome. It's in the statistics at this point where between taxus, the yews, and arborvitae, and what I suspect... This is actually a really interesting story because I was, I got to meet with a grower and they were having problems in their crops. It's a nursery, plant nursery. And they have lost hundreds of plants. And so we went into one of their hoop houses. It was full of yews. And there was, and I've used this picture in some of my presentations where you can see that some of them are definitely more yellow than others. And they were really concerned that on the branch tips, the branch tips were starting to die. So they're like, oh, is it a tip blight like Phomopsis, Pestilosia, one of those? And I'm like, no, the primary problem is a root rot. And I kind of made the comment because their plant healthcare manager was there. I'm like, yeah, I've seen more and more that people say they assume that all root rots are Phytophthora, so they treat it for Phytophthora. And all those true fungi are totally fine and they're unfazed. And it was funny that the plant healthcare manager is like, we treat this for Phytophthora. I'm like, of course you did. Treat them for Rhizoctonia. And you know what? I bet in 3 weeks they'll start recovering. Wow. So, and that's where everybody assumes it's a, if root rot, if a bleeding canker must be Phytophthora, right? I'm like, well, I've found three other pathogens that cause bleeding cankers on oaks. So you are, you know, it's a three-way gamble on what it is. And so having them diagnosed, you're actually using fewer pesticides. And to have that diagnosed at most state labs is probably around $30. It's going to be usually an ELISA test, and you'll get the results back. And that's timing. It's really hard in plant healthcare and state labs, is they're under-resourced. And so sometimes the turnaround time is longer than people would like. And so the one thing I've been pointing out too is if plant diagnostics had the same budget as human diagnostics, we could also give you an ELISA test in 24 hours.
Wow.
But we don't have labs running 24 hours a day.
Right.
And so some of the best labs in the country, and the busiest labs in the country, you're still probably looking at a 2 or 3 week turnaround time. And part of it is, like with verticillium, it's going to take 2 weeks. You can't make a fungus grow faster. No matter how many expletives you throw at it.
See, there's another disease that's poking its head again. It's popping up again a lot more.
Yeah. And I think some of that, so one, verticillium is, there aren't native populations of verticillium. You don't go into the forest and find verticillium like you would Dutch elm disease, oak wilt, armillaria, those. Verticillium is solely a nursery plant problem. And then once you
urban forest area.
Yeah. Because it's the primary movement of verticillium is on nursery stock. And it's really difficult because people start seeing the wilting. And so first, you know, most people say, oh, well, water it more. And then when watering makes it worse, and it's a Phytophthora, treat for Phytophthora. And by that time, how many weeks have gone by and they just lost their crop versus having it diagnosed immediately.
Wow. That's a whole podcast right there on diagnostics.
I know. I was going to say we should have her back on because we're almost out of time.
Yeah. And I could talk about diagnostics. Like I want the whole green industry to start investing in diagnostics.
Joe, we should do kind of one of our first episodes was the diagnostic checklist. We should have Stephanie back on and maybe talk about a modern or bringing it kind of up to speed, up to par.
A critiquer, because you know, we went by as a practicing arborist checklist. And I think we made assumptions back then, which again, I'm sitting here, I mean, I got notes all over my desk and I'm thinking, well, heck, I got all, now you just gave me 30 more questions for you, Stephanie. And we don't have the time to do it. I'm thinking, doggone it. Now I got to write this one down.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm just drumming up job security.
Oh my God. And then some.
The one thing that I've also encountered is professionals kind of grumbling about how that's all they knew, right? You know, it's like, you know, or kind of being frustrated that, you know, oh, well, we've been doing it wrong for so long. And I want to remind people is we did the best we could with the knowledge and resources we had available, right? And as long as you did it in good faith, that's the best you can do, you know? And again, going back to the learning, we're always learning. And so that's one reason why these, the root rots and that sort, I've been talking about so much, because they have been overlooked. We've been taught what woody structural roots should look like at planting, but nobody looks at, well, how do the fine roots look at planting? Reading through the questions before we started, one of the questions is, what's kind of on my mind, you know, moving forward? And one of the big questions is looking at new plantings, especially street tree plantings. The Arboretum has a really great working relationship with the surrounding municipalities. And so we help each other out quite a bit, which is a really fantastic opportunity in many ways. So they see, you know, they're on the planting side of things, or their contractors are doing the planting. And so the curiosity is like, you know, I would love to go through their planting data, or after 10 years, how many of them died within 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then 10 years. And then, because one thing I'm finding talking with nursery professionals, which I really admire nursery folks, like they're primary producers. And again, they do the best they can with the resources and knowledge that they have, and they want to produce a good product. They want every plant that leaves their property to do well. But when a tree dies in a landscape, the people who planted it blame the nursery, and the nursery blames the planting, and nobody's actually looking to see why that tree died. And so I'm hoping in the future, you know, I have to write for some grants or get money to do this research. But actually, I've been talking to some municipal foresters. I'm like, can I just come into your holding yard when you get all your nursery stock in? And I just want to survey them to see how healthy they are above and below ground. And then we can track, you know, so many of a different the same species, and see how they actually do. And then check them every year. And if they start declining, and seeing, you know, how can we stop this, or where did the problem lie? Because right now it's just finger pointing and not actually identifying the primary problem.
That would be really neat to do. And I know Dr. Bert Craig at Michigan University.
Yeah.
Container grown, and how they end up later in the tree's life. But that, you know, it's amazing to think about something like that, because, and I know we're wrapping up. You got me so excited that I just want to keep talking, but Corey, you wrap it up when we got to, but I keep bringing that up to a lot of the, like, relief around the country has some really great programs where they're planting trees around states. And I had this question over the last year, who's keeping an eye on them after you guys leave? You get the band, the newspaper, we're planting trees, and everybody disappears. What happens to those trees 3, 5, 10 years later? And what's the success rate? And I love that. That's a whole nother topic too.
And that's where I'm like, planting a tree is easy. We should focus on growing trees. But some of these planting initiatives, like there was one, I remember, I think it was an ISA conference, I don't know how many years ago, that it was a planting initiative in California, I think it was Los Angeles, where they did this huge planting study. And then they did go back to see how many of them survived. And I know there have been many surveys like that. And even at the Arboretum, we're doing a lot of planting initiatives. And so I'm communicating with the Arboretum employee who's instrumental in that. And so looking at that, I'm like, this is a citizen science project. Like, we're working with those, you know, community leaders to get these trees planted, and, you know, giving the people who want the trees so they'll take care of them. But I'm like, that's a perfect citizen science program right there.
Yeah, you send them annually a one-page document. They walk out there, cheat sheet their notes, and get them back to you. Yep. The data you could collect would be so easy.
Yeah.
Stephanie, we're grateful. I think we covered a lot of things, a lot of really good content in this episode. Is there any way that people can either follow you on any social media channels or look you up if they have additional questions about some of the things that we've covered?
Sure. So I am on LinkedIn, so you can follow me there. And then I do have a Facebook page. I think most of my references are using the name Tree Pathologist. Stephanie Adams is a really common name that has been used all up. My Arboretum email address is sadams@mortonarb.org. Which you can, I think you find that on the Arboretum website, or, you know,
put in the show notes.
Yeah, it's around. But yeah, they can shoot me emails. Because yeah, I always liked hearing what's going, what are people seeing in people's backyards? I don't get it. That's one thing I miss about not being in the field is not getting in people's backyards and actually hearing what they're doing or where they're learning these things. So talking to arborist or it's always great. You always learn something.
Awesome. Perfect. Well, on behalf of Joe, myself, our producer, and all of the listeners, thank you again so much. Really just humbled that you took the time and super appreciative. So thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Hey, great topic today.
Yes, and lots of good information.
Yeah, probably one of our best yet.
If you enjoyed the podcast or have topics you would like to discuss, please send them to discoveringforestry@gmail.com. And please hit the subscribe button and tell a friend.
Thanks, guys, for tuning in. Until next time, I'm Joe.
And I'm Corey.
Signing out.